feeling so good. It feels so natural.
What's something you've written and you've just gone, I can't know?
You can look at it and kind of try and learn from the things you've been through.
You write songs, right?
I've read that a few times too.
I know, we've sold that many records. On the Best Bits this week, Anton Newcombe from Brian Jonestown Massacre talked to me about why he hates the stark white walls of his Berlin studio and what he plans to do about it. And Megan Spencer reviews the Patti Smith Horses Anniversary Tour in Berlin. First up, when I spoke to the multi-talented Cookie Blaze from Fat Freddy's Drop, he was in the middle of writing some menus for a very special event.
When we have a release or a media event, or thank you to the all the people who work with us, you know, tour promoters and, you know, just friends of people who are making our T-shirts and all that, just our extended family of people who do stuff for us. And we get, when we have an opportunity, we get them together before these large things like releasing a record or a new tour. And we cook and we and sort of invite them and we host an event.
Aww.
We design the menu and we do the cooking.
So what are you going to cook?
I was just doing the menu. I was starting off with some oysters from, so simple things, you know, oysters from a particular bay down here in Marlborough, which I'm just in love with their oysters at the moment. So starting with the oysters, and then I'm making a smoked moki, which is one of our good fish, smoked moki croquette. So it's just a fried croquette with a chili quince sauce. And then abalone is power. We call it power wontons, but they're abalone.
Oh, can I come?
QB, Japanese mayo. Of course you can. Over you come.
Oh,
and then I'm making
unreal.
Fried chicken. My new fried chicken recipe.
Oh, what's in it? What's in your new fried chicken recipe? Tell me your secret herbs and spices.
I can't.
Oh, come on.
I can't do that. There's no way. The Colonel held on to his 11. It's got more than 11 anyway, I'm telling you that much.
So good.
But, yeah, so that's the kind of thing. And then, you know, everyone comes along and has, and we feed them for a couple of hours and have drinks and have a chat and say thanks. And then we go home and have a cup of tea and go to bed because the next day we've got a big gig.
When did you discover your love of cooking for others? Has it been something that you do when you're on the road?
Yeah, I've done plenty of cooking on the road. And I just enjoy cooking and we all enjoy eating. And cooking's one of those things that just we do. It creates a little bit of a family feeling, I suppose, with people that you don't know too well or just getting to know. There's a lot of people that work with you within the music industry, you know, people that are doing different jobs for you in all sorts of different countries. So wherever there is an opportunity to be able to have an event that, you know, where we can host, then we take the opportunity.
And your audience, though, is very much part of your community. You've worked from the grassroots up, haven't you? It's a very different way of going about music, and I think it's worked wonderfully well for you guys.
Yeah, we've done it. We did it. You know, we took a different model. We kind of created our own, but you know, a lot of people did do the same thing at the same time. It's just the industry opened up and allowed musicians to be able to take, you know, complete responsibility of their direction if they wanted to, or there was the option to work with, you know, obviously to work with record labels still is. But for us, yeah, we were lucky. Everyone was on the same page with that idea. And it actually wasn't an option because of so many of us, what the labels were offering simply wasn't going to sustain us as individuals at the time. And we could see that there was a risk involved in doing it independently, but it actually was the only option because we had to give that a go because we just knew we wouldn't be able to make enough money halving it or less with a record label at that point. It's been a slow build, a slow burn, but it's worked. It's a pretty comfortable way to make music. We have a lot of time, you know, to come up with the ideas and to polish, to be able to produce the song, the sound of the songs that we want to produce. There's no time constraint. Not completely no time constraint. There's a little bit, but it's not the traditional model of having to get into a studio and bang out tunes quite quickly.
Yeah.
We've built our own studio, and it's you know over the time, and it's because of that we're able to spend the time we do on the tunes, and that's just over to the loyalty of the fans, really.
Yeah. Well, this one is a complete studio album, which is quite different for the band, as you said. You usually test stuff out on the road. Tell me about the process from when it began to when it finished.
I can't really remember when it began. I mean, they all do begin in similar ways in that we go back over an archive of small composition and concepts and ideas that have popped up anywhere between soundcheck and studio jams or getting together, you know, because we've got screeds of that stuff in the hard drive, so And luckily we've got one guy in the band who just, he's the librarian, he just knows where everything is. So, you know, quite often these ideas will have taken shape over some time. Little bits of them may have been dropped at quite often at soundcheck or in the studio and sort of just refreshed and put back in our sort of thought processes, and then gradually they start to evolve.
New in music every Saturday arvo. Grey Jane was a river child. Kaz Tran brings you the best new tracks from the week. And she wants you, but you won't throw up your hands and pray. The week in music with Kaz Tran. Saturday afternoons from 2 on Double J.
Miff's Best Bits on Double J. Megan Spencer has written a rather extraordinary article that's up on the Double J website, and Megan is on the phone from Berlin right now to tell us all about it. Hi, Megan.
Hello, Miff. How are you?
I'm good. So much better for talking to you. What are you doing in Berlin?
Oh, back at you. Well, I'm living here now. I bit the bullet. You know how there's a little exodus of Australians living elsewhere? Well, I came to Germany. I came to the capital.
Yeah.
I guess I was lucky enough to see Patti Smith not long ago. She's on her 40th anniversary tour for this amazing album.
Well, tell us about it now before we read it. Mm. The concert is obviously travelling around the world at the moment.
Yep. She's on a world tour with us.
Yeah.
And I think it'll probably end up in States, I'm pretty sure, on November 10th, which I think is the actual release date for Horses from 1975, 40 years ago. Patti Smith had intended to play a concert for it, for Horses in New York, to kind of celebrate it and bring it full circle, because we all know that she is a creature of New York. That's where she cut her teeth as a poet and an artist and a musician, you know, so many years ago. And she has done the rounds pretty much around America and in Europe with the concert. She's playing with two of her original Horses collaborators, and that's drummer J.D. Doherty and, of course, Lenny Kaye, who's been right by her side since she decided to make that leap from being a poet and a performance artist into rock and roll music and eventually, you know, morphing into what she's known now as the godmother of punk,
yep,
of course. I have to tell you, Miff, it was an incredibly special night. Like, I have come to Patti Smith late, I fully admit.
I want to get to that, but keep talking.
Yes, so it made it even more special in a sense. I mean, this is what I love about life. Our sense of discovery never goes away. I have reasons for coming to Patti late, which I'll tell you about later, but to turn up to this strange, otherworldly and beautiful kind of smaller venue called the Tempodrom, which Berlin's quite known for. It's got like a circus tent or even like a spaceship. It's got a weird pointy roof. And it's quite deceiving. So from the outside it looks small, but you go inside and it's a 10,000-seater and it's quite vast. Or I think, no, sorry, 5,000-seater. But there were just people streaming in from outside when I got there. Eventually, you know, I was one of the stragglers. And it was a beautiful night, like a Berlin summer night, so just incredibly special. And there was this real festive atmosphere. You could feel it. Everyone was so happy to be there, and they're munching on their bratwursts and drinking their beer. And in a sense, no one wanted to go in because they were so happy out, you know, soaking up this atmosphere. But, of course, they did want to go in because Patti Smith was about to play. And she summoned us from inside that circus tent. I can tell you, you could hear her roaring out Gloria, which is the first song on Horses. She just went straight into playing.
Wow.
The album, and it was track by track in track order and then some other songs after it. So we all kind of flew in there. And I have to tell you, I teared up. I started shaking.
I would have been
like
the same.
A little kid seeing the Beatles or something, name your favourite artist. But I started shaking and weeping as I sat down, and I thought, I have to get myself together or I'm going to miss it. But she's so formidable.
Yeah.
Like, she looks like a goddess, and she's so sort of masculine, feminine, and she's so high art and lowbrow at the same time. You know, Philip Shaw, who I sort of mentioned in my article, is a scholar who's written about Horses and why he thinks it's the greatest rock and roll album ever. And he talks about her collapsing high and low art in every sense in her music, and that's why she occupies a very unique space in rock.
And maybe why she's loved so much. Yeah, maybe that's why she's loved, because you can actually relate to her.
Yeah, very much. And she thinks better of us, and she thinks better of herself too. That's very much there. She's an optimist. She's not like a sort of leather-clad, sweaty, dour, you know, pessimist. On that stage, she believes in art. She sings about lots of pain and suffering too, but she also sings about how we can be the best version of ourselves. So I don't know, I just got quite overwhelmed at the prospect of experiencing her in concert for the first time.
Oh, Megan, you've given me goosebumps, because that's something I would just I couldn't imagine seeing. I've seen Patti Smith play, of course. She's toured a lot, but I've never seen that, and I've never seen her do that album, which means so much to me and to so many others.
Miff's Best Bits on Double J.
You know that they were named in tribute to the Rolling Stones guitarist Brian Jones, of course. The Brian Jonestown Massacre have forged their own unique path for the last 25 years. 25 years, my goodness. They're touring their Jubilee show next month, as well as releasing a collector's EP featuring all of the new tracks, which you'll be able to pick up at the shows. Anton Newcombe. We know him. We love him. He isn't known for being the shy and retiring type. And I caught up with him on the phone just a few days ago. And while I expected to talk about a few different topics, I also expected that he'd be very passionate about those topics. And he didn't disappoint. He firstly explained why he was painting his studio in Berlin purple and orange.
Well, let me describe Germany. You know, unless you're gay, right, or have a gay decorator, everything's white, you know, it's like white interiors. You know, it's the opposite of somebody like living in the thick of it in Sydney or something, where everybody's like, no, I'm going to paint my house black with purple trim. Check it out. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Which other parts of Scandinavia, they're really into it with the green interiors and all the stuff. But in Germany and Switzerland and stuff, it's just like very boring to me. So the first thing that had to go is the industrial lights and the gloss white interior. It just drives me bananas. And that looks great if you're in a museum, or if you have this like $5 million space where you're like, oh yeah, that's my Louis XV era dresser. You know, it's just like, cool.
Yeah, you're right. You've got to make it yours, don't you, in a place like that where everything else is kind of slick and just dull.
I mean, even if I don't do drugs anymore, I want to look like I do. You know, like, kind of.
Yeah, so many things to talk about, Anton. You've got the new EP, which is on the way, the Thingy Wingy, which I loved. Tell me about that. Uh-huh. I know you go into the studio all the time and you record so much stuff. You're very prolific. How did you narrow it down to these particular tracks?
Most of the time, a friend of mine or somebody will, you know, because I like to share, and I share works in progress, but most of the time, you know, a friend of mine or somebody will hear it and just go, this is so amazing. You got to try and finish this one and share it with people because it's blowing me away. So there's a little bit of peer pressure that goes on. And there's the pressure of having to do something sometimes, like to tour, I generally. Since we're not really a retro project, meaning resting on our laurels, we're always putting something out, as opposed to like, oh, hi, we're going to play this album from 1992 all the way through or something.
So you want to keep making new things. You are driven. What's the drive in you then to keep doing that? Because there's a lot of bands, as you said, that are now doing that whole looking back, you know, celebrating the past. But you've kind of kept moving all the time. Why do you think that is? What is it about your personality that wants to keep creating?
I enjoy music. So I enjoy creating music and working and trying to get better and all this stuff. So that's first and foremost. And I don't think I'm done learning. I've always worked in sort of conceptual art, trying to make up ideas, not finishing them to perfection or something. Like, I'm not trying to compete with Nigel Goodrich and Radiohead on the audio quality of a record, you know. And just the thought of that always was stifling to me. Although I would like to work with some of these people in the future, that concept allows me something to look forward to. If they would, you know, Tony Visconti or one of these guys would want to do something.
Yeah.
But to me, their whole mindset of collecting, like, okay, I need 500,000 pounds from a record label and let's record a record, is just so reverse from me trying to empower people. No, just learn a guitar, get your mates and do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense, totally.
Yeah, because I come from the other ethos of just, it's like a folk music thing that happens to be wrapped in whatever it is, psych, folk rock, or whatever you want to define it as.
Yeah, definitely. And look, you know, I think because of that, you've lasted 25 years, which is probably something I imagine you didn't expect at the beginning. Would that be right?
Well, time is irrelevant to me, really. Before I started taking medication, because it was getting crazier and crazier, in my more manic phases, you know, a month was like a day with just little naps in between. I've always treated my life that way, sort of, you know, just lay down to rest when I'm tired. So I never really thought about the terms of longevity or any of these types of things. What I wanted to do was, music was my insurance policy, you know, and I wanted to use music to create the space to where I could make music, have it pay for itself.
Yeah.
And to provide for me, so I wouldn't have the outside worries. Now, life's problems, they continuously pop up no matter what it is, right? So you're never free of that stuff on some certain level. I certainly have created the space to make music that supports itself.
Catch up with Miff Warhurst for lunch. Weekdays from 11 on Double J.